You are listening to Father Roderick, and I'm finally back after a three-week hiatus. I'll tell you all about it later on in this show, but this episode, just like all the others that I've recorded in my career as a podcasting priest, are full of geek news and movie reviews and technology and so much more. So sit back, relax, and enjoy. Well, I've been out of the loop for about 3 weeks, and the reason was I've been working so hard. There was just so much work. Not to mention that I also moved to a new rectory with all the, you know, the extra effort that comes with that. And I don't think I've recovered yet from all those changes. But anyway, I'm back here tomorrow morning. That's in a few hours' time because I'm recording this late in the evening. I'm traveling to the Holy Land for a pilgrimage of about 7 days with, 500 to 800 fellow Dutchmen. I have to film the pilgrimage or make a television show about it. So that's going to be another busy, busy week. And I just didn't want to leave you for another week. Then it would have been a month. And I miss you all. I miss podcasting. I miss talking about the stuff that I like. So I'm going to try to squeeze out that final drop of energy that's left in me. And then I'll probably sleep for, what is it, a few hours. And then I fly to Israel. Oh, well. Let's talk about the news.
Do you know what's going on?
This is what's happening in your world.
They said Catholics rule. We got Boston, South America, the good part of Ireland, and we're making serious inroads in Mozambique, baby.
You've taken your first step into a larger world.
So these past 3 weeks, I think I've produced, filmed, and sometimes edited, I think, 4 or 5 television episodes, which is an insane amount of work. I already filmed 2 Christmas episodes. The reason that I'm doing so much work, and I'm also pre-producing a film TV episodes for next year, is that I want to free up as much as possible the month of December. Because that's the final, well, of course, it's the month of Christmas. And after Christmas, for the first time in years, I'm taking some time off. And I want to be, you know, really done with work once Christmas is there. And also, January the 1st, or at least the first week of January, we're starting this new Catholic channel in the Netherlands, which also requires a lot of preparation right now. So I try to do as much as possible. So it was really, really weird. About a week ago, we went to the south of the Netherlands. I also talk about this in The Walk, by the way. And I had to do interviews pretending that it was winter and that it was cold. And it was one of the warmest weeks in Dutch history. It was just beautiful weather. And I had to walk there on camera with my winter coat on. I was sweating. I was so hot. And I had to pretend that it was cold. And then we all the people that we interviewed, of course, they don't have their Christmas decorations up. So we took Christmas decorations with us and put them in the background of all these people. So television, of course, as you know, it's all smoke and mirrors. It's all, you know, imagination and fakery. But, you know, if it liberates me for these final weeks of the year, then I'm going to be very happy that I put in the work right now. Because I don't remember the last year that Christmas was a quiet time. I've always been extremely busy. December would also always be the month of the fun drive that we would do. So that would require so much extra work. I never had the opportunity to take some time off after Christmas. Well, this time I'm going to take 2 weeks off, which is really, really insane. But I need it. I needed to, well, for instance, put my house in order. I moved to the other rectory. By the way, since the last time we spoke, at least on this podcast, I ran a marathon of Amsterdam, ran my fastest time ever. So I was really proud of that. I'm still recovering from that physically as well. This morning I did my first big, you know, 1 hour run in my new environment, in the new area where I live. And it felt really great to be running again. But anyway, I still have most of my stuff in boxes. The fridge is not working in the new rectory, so I have to order a new one. I've got a spare one from someone that someone still had in their basement, I think. And I don't have a washing machine. I don't have a dryer. I have running water. That's really cool. But it's really, it feels like I'm camping out in my own house. I don't have a desk. That's another thing. I do have, and I'm super excited about that. I do have a very cool Harry Potter / Tolkien Shire Middle Earth type of reading chair that I picked up at on a sale at IKEA's. And it's one of those faux leather ones, which looks a bit old-fashioned. I put it in front of the fireplace where there's, by the way, nothing because, well, one of my predecessors in the rectory has completely, I don't know, just they took out the fireplace, which is like, how could you? It's like, who doesn't dream of having a real fireplace? Well, they took it out. So now I'm trying to figure out if I can either restore it or put in like a fake fireplace. I want to sit and read books at the fire. That's my dream, you know. When I visited the Hobbit set in Matamata in New Zealand, you end your tour of the Shire in the, what is it, the Green Dragon Inn or one of those inns. And the last time I visited, because I've been there twice, the last time it was a cold, rainy day in spring, and I was frozen because I'd been filming outside for hours and hours, and then you come in the warmth of that place, and there is, you can get a Hobbit beer. Yeah, and there is I think a pie. I ate a pie, a warm pie, and I sat in a big leather chair in front of the fire, a fireplace, and I was like, okay, when I'm old and rich, I will build myself a Hobbit home like this. Well, now I have the occasion. So, but anyway, all that still has to be done. I have my chair. I'm already reading in that chair. And all the rest is still incredibly empty. It's a very big house compared to the apartment where I lived previously. So it's got way too many rooms for me. I don't know what to do with all those rooms. I don't have much stuff either. So I want to take some time off during the Christmas holiday to make it cozy, to clean up, to come up with, you know, decorate the house a little bit, make it a little bit more like home. But before that, I have to go to the Holy Land. And that's going to be the first time in my life that I visit the Holy Land. I've never been there on a pilgrimage. I've been to many other places like Lourdes and Fatima and of course, the Vatican. But Assisi, never been to Israel, never been to Jerusalem and Nazareth and Bethlehem. All that is on the schedule. I have it here in front of me in this little booklet that they gave me. So tomorrow, I'm recording this on Wednesday evening, November 14. Tomorrow morning, we'll arrive at around 5 o'clock in Tel Aviv. Then we'll take the bus to Nazareth. By the way, I'm part of a group of people with disabilities or people that are ill, and so people that need accompaniment. There are many other groups that are also traveling to the Holy Land. Some have a different program for most of the week. But we'll all get together later on next week. So we'll be in Nazareth. That's where I'll stay my first day. Then on Friday, we'll go to the Mountain of the Beatitudes, which is pretty cool. Then we'll go to Capernaum, I think. We'll have a boat tour on the Lake of Galilee. I'm reading this for the first time. That's how busy I've been. I'm only now discovering what the trip will be about. So we'll have a boat tour on the Lake of Galilee. Well, that's pretty cool as well. Then we'll go again to, we'll visit Nazareth. And on Saturday, we'll go to Qasr el-Yahud. We'll have lunch in Jericho. That sounds so cool. Like, we'll have lunch in Jericho. There is a visit to the Death Sea. And then we'll stay in Jerusalem. And on Sunday, we'll go to the Fields of the Shepherds, whatever that may be. We'll have lunch in Bethlehem. We'll visit the bazaar. We'll celebrate the Eucharist at the Church of St. Catherine. We'll visit the Birth of the Nativity Church. And then we'll stay for another night in Jerusalem. Then on Monday, we'll go to the Olive Mountain or Olive Mount, the Church of the Ascension, the Our Father Church, the Dominus Flevit and the Church of All Nations. I had
no, like 10% of those places.
And then we'll, in the after lunch, we'll visit the, among other things, the Room of the Last Supper and the Church of the, Cock's Crow? Crow, something like, wow. Okay. Then on Tuesday, we'll visit the Old City, the Temple Square and the Western Wall. Then in the afternoon, there is an optional visit to Yad Vashem. And on Wednesday, we'll walk the Via Dolorosa and end in the Holy Sepulchre Church. We'll celebrate Mass at St. Anna's. And on Thursday, I'll go back home. So it looks like most of the time we'll be in Jerusalem. And then from there, I think we'll just probably drive around a little bit. I don't know what to expect. I don't know what I'm going to film. I'll just wing it. That's the only thing I can do. I'll just take my pajama and my camera. What else do you need in life? Not much, right? All right, let's talk movies.
How do you not like movies?
They're predictable. Like, the guy gets the girl and that kid sees dead people and Darth Vader is Luke's father.
Not liking movies is like not liking puppies.
They're fine. I just get bored and never make it to the end.
You know, you need a movie education. You need a moviecation. I'm going to give it to you.
I just came back from the second movie in the wizarding universe of Harry Potter. Well, we know it from Harry Potter, but these new movies are prequels, and they are about the Fantastic Beasts and all the stories that take place in New York and in this movie in Paris. And we get introduced to a number of new characters, as well as some familiar ones. And in this movie, we'll get to see the young Albus Dumbledore, which is pretty cool. And this movie takes us back for a short time, too short, in my opinion, to Hogwarts Castle, where, of course, the School of Witchcraft and Wizardry has been located for many centuries. I liked the first movie. I wasn't a very big fan. I think it's because I didn't really grow up, but most of the time that I studied in Rome, I was reading Harry Potter, and Harry Potter was kind of my little escape when I had too much study, too much work to do in my communications work. I just escape into this wondrous world of Harry Potter and his friends, and you get attached to these friends, and it becomes your world, and at least an imaginary world as well. Then, of course, you got all the movies, which are tremendously well done, and this movie just takes you to another time and another place, and a lot of the familiar stuff that was part of the Harry Potter universe is no longer there. There were many good things about the movie as well. What I really liked was this kind of fresh approach where it's no longer about kids, but it's about the adult world of wizards and witches. But it's the same old fight against the darkness and those that use magic for dark purposes. And of course, that is the overarching theme in so many of the movies and franchises that I like, whether it is Star Wars or the Marvel Universe. It makes it instantly like a mythological story. The main villain of the first movie was only revealed at the end. And in case you haven't seen the first movie, I won't spoil it for you. But that bad guy is kind of in the title of this second movie. But we not only get to introduce to this Grindelwald, this bad guy, played by Johnny Depp, by the way, which is was quite controversial because in his private life there was all sorts of stuff going on and there was quite a bit of online backlash against the casting of Johnny Depp. I have to say, by the way, that he did great. He is a very believable and very scary villain in this movie. But we also get introduced to the new hero, let's say, of this new sequence of movies. I think they're going to be 6 or 7 or something like that, which is Newt Scamander, the writer of the book about fantastic beasts and where to find them, which is kind of one of the reference books that they use in the era of Harry Potter, and it's study material for them. So now we meet the author, Newt. He's played by Eddie Redmayne. In the first movie, I had trouble connecting with him. He felt a bit absent. He was never looking at people. He was always looking away, very shy, almost a bit on the autism spectrum. And it's kind of the impression that it gave. In this second movie, the same thing, but I get to appreciate it more because it's part of who he is and how he looks at the world. And there are a few moments where he does look into the eyes of other people, and that gives it so much more impact. And it always happens with people that he truly trusts. And so it's very subtle acting by Eddie Redmayne. And in the first movie, it kind of threw me off. In the second movie, I'm really enjoying his performance as a Newt Scamander. We also get introduced to one of my favorite actors in this new movie series, Jacob Kowalski, a nomad. That's how the Muggles are called in North America. And Dan Fogler, who portrays Jacob, does such a great job. It's a really comedic character, but also extremely likable. And then we get the two sisters, Queenie Goldstein and Tina Goldstein, played by Alison Sudol and Catherine Waterston. They were great in the first movie. They're equally great in the second movie. And there is character development there, especially with Queenie. Big character development. And I really appreciated that. There is the character of Credence Barebone, who was one of the most mysterious characters in the first movie. He comes back big time in this movie. And that's all I can say about it because, well, go see the movie and you'll know why I don't want to talk about it. There is something more to him than meets the eye. And there's already a lot of scary stuff meeting the eye for the character that we know. He's played by Ezra Miller. Of course, we know him as the actor who played the Flash in the Justice League movie. Very, very different type of role in this movie. Similar to the way he portrayed Credence in the first movie. There's not much development there, but sets it up for much, much more in the future. Jude Law plays Albus Dumbledore, which is really an interesting choice. Not an actor that I would associate with the character of Dumbledore that we know from the Harry Potter movies. But I think it works. It kind of works. It doesn't really try to channel the older Dumbledore. He has his own style. But you kind of You accept him as Dumbledore. He's not as prominent in the movie as I thought he would be. It's still all about Newt and Tina and Jacob and Queenie, and to a lesser extent about Credence. Grindelwald, Gellert Grindelwald, is one used to be in a relationship with Albus Dumbledore, and they had a fallout. And then he became this extremely dangerous wizard, very, very violent and vicious. One of the few villains in these movies that doesn't get a pass. Like, one of the most beautiful moments in this movie is one of the characters, Tina Goldstein, Alita. Alita Lestrange, played by Zoe Kravitz. By the way, excellent role as well. She reveals, stuff is revealed about her past, and she is extremely, uncertain about herself, etc. And then Newt Scamander really accepts her and continues to see good in her. And then she says a beautiful quote, or a beautiful phrase, like, "You're the only person who always sees the good in any monster." And she's referring to herself in a certain way. So, and that's what I like about Newt Scamander. He's very much like like a child. And the way he what he learned from the fantastic beasts, from the animals and magical creatures that he takes care of, is that even though sometimes we judge these creatures, these you know, there's this big dragon in this movie, very, very cool, by the way, and everybody's afraid of that creature except for Newt. And he is so used to looking with a positive eye to these creatures. He knows that when they're violent, it's because they're hungry, because they're afraid. And so he always tries to find ways to connect with these animals and to gain their trust. And what's beautiful about the second movie, and that wasn't as present in the first movie, is that he has that same attitude towards any human being around him, whether it is a wizard or a witch or a muggle or a nomad. And it makes him very, very likable. It's just someone who doesn't judge and who knows that behind every type of behavior, there's a reason. There's pain. There is unresolved issues, etc. And what he tries to do is to heal that. So he's a bit of a doctor as well, a healer. You could say very different from Harry Potter, but also in a certain way, a bit of a messiah archetype. You know, the way that Jesus looked at people around him was always with love, even to the people that nailed him to the cross. He forgave them. And he was critical, and he could be strict with people, but it was always to try to change them, to try to give them an insight in their behavior and to change their ways. Well, Newt's commander in these stories has a very similar attitude. That may be one of those kind of Christian influences in this storyline. One exception in this movie, at least, is Grindelwald, who is so purely evil. He's kind of like a Hitler type of character, the way he presents himself, the way he tries to gain people for his cause. And I think at one point you see that his castle is in Austria, so there are definitely some open, clear hints that this is the Hitler of the magical, of the wizarding world. He's portrayed by Johnny Depp in a very different way than, you know, Jack Sparrow's character, for instance. Johnny Depp here is very serious, he's holding back a lot. He doesn't overact, which makes Grindelwald even scarier. Plus, he's got this strange, weird, white eye, and he is creepy. The opening scene, by the way, awesome, awesome, awesome. Half of the time I didn't understand what was going on, but this movie does that all the time. You get so much information, there's so much happening that, like, half the movie I was processing, wait, what, huh? What did just happen? What did they just say? And it's one of the, perhaps also one of the flaws of the movie, at least one of the issues that critics had with this movie, is that there's too much in it. It's an information dump. One critic called it the George Lucas disease, where in the prequels George Lucas, you know, moved from telling simple stories like the ones in New Hope and Empire Strikes Back. It's kind of very clear storyline, nothing too complicated. And then in the prequels, you know, he tried to retcon everything and tried to weave the tapestry that would lead to the events in the existing trilogy, and also trying to give us new information that would make us look differently at some of this of the events in the existing movies. Well, in a way, according to some, J.K. Rowling tried to do the same in this movie, just giving so much backstory and hints and Easter eggs and information and introducing all sorts of twists that, especially towards the end, I think that is, for me, that became a problem. It was really hard to follow, and but I didn't mind. I actually enjoyed it. I was like, this movie has more substance than the first movie. The first movie is like, okay, can we get going now? There was a lot of what seemed like gratuitous scenes with all sorts of magical creatures that slowed down the movie at certain points. And I felt that in the first movie, there wasn't enough of a storyline. It was just felt a bit, I don't know. At the end of the movie, it was like, this was great, but it's you know, when are we going to really start this story? Well, in this movie, that's what happens. Even though, again, it suffers a bit from, I don't know, perhaps some structural problems where you feel like the buildup is kind of, I don't know, even, and but there is a climax at the end of the movie, but it's much more of a visual climax where it's really like they're amping up the action and the magical action, but there is not much of a emotional build up to solidify that, to make that stronger. So there is a big reveal at the end of the movie, but that was not enough for me to feel like, whoa, I can't believe what just happened. So it still feels like we're preparing the future. She's still rolling, is still building the characters, is setting the chess pieces in place for what comes next. So that may be disappointing for some people. I, on the other hand, I'm like, there is so much to discover. There's so much to see. This world, which at first, for a lot of people, they said, how can you follow the Harry Potter saga with something of equal weight? That story was so well constructed and so well done. It almost felt like, you know, Fantastical Beasts and Where to Find Them was like trying to expand on something that in itself didn't have much consistency, because you can't really do the whole Voldemort thing again. You can't have those that quest for the fragments of the soul of Voldemort that really was a driving, you know, story of the Harry Potter saga. None of that is present in this movie or in these stories. So people were worried. I was worried too that it would be a little bit of a, I don't know, a downgrade compared to the Harry Potter saga. Less content. Well, this movie shows that Rowling has actually really developed the backstory of that world. And so she does a lot of world building, which I think works. But it does require, I think, a second viewing. For me, at least. Or perhaps I should read the script. Is it the script they call that? The screenplay. That's the word I was looking for. So she doesn't really write books now. That's another big difference with the Harry Potter movies. The Harry Potter movies were kind of like a condensed version of the books. In with these new movies, she's only writing screenplays. And I think she enjoys it very much. She's working with Yates, who's the director of the movie. She's worked with him for many other movies, the Harry Potter movies. And that seems to be a very good chemistry between those two. I like the world building. I want to see more, and I'm curious. Another thing that I really enjoyed in this second movie is that they go to Paris. And it's, of course, Paris. It's Paris in olden times. This takes place decades before Harry Potter. And I think they did a great job. Of course, they show you the glorified, the fairy tale version of Paris, which always makes me laugh a little bit. If you've ever been to Paris, it's a great city. It's beautiful, but it's a busy city as well. And it's not as romantic as most movies try to make it seem. I mean, you see all the highlights. Wherever you stand, you see the Eiffel Tower, or you see Montmartre, or you see, there's a glimpse of the cathedral, just a very short glimpse. I don't know why they don't show the Notre Dame more often in the movie. And then everything looks a bit like, it's like Ratatouille, you know, about the rat who cooks. It's that kind of Paris. I love it. But it's a romantic version of Paris, not the real Paris. So don't be disappointed if you ever visit Paris that it doesn't look like what you saw in The Crimes of Grindelwald. What else is there to say about the movie? One other thing that I really enjoyed, I don't think that many people pay attention to that, but the music, the soundtrack was awesome. It was one of the composers that did, I'm trying to look this up on IMDb. Where's the entire list here? Full cast? No, that's not what I'm looking for. Who did the soundtrack? Ooh, IMDb sometimes can be really cast and crew. written by, directed by David Yates. We got an incredibly long list of actors, producers. Oh, there you go. James Newton Howard. I think he did the second movie, the second Harry Potter movie or something like that. The third. I think he did the third Harry Potter movie. Let's see. Let me look that up now that I'm at IMDb. I can look all of that up. He did a ton of movies. He's one of my favorite newer movie composers. The Water Horse, I remember that one. It was great. He did ER? Huh. Composer of the theme music of ER. I didn't know that. Well, that's crazy. Or perhaps he was involved in it. I don't know. Soundtrack. Let's click that. Soundtrack. What is this? Am I looking at the right composer here? Maleficent. Return to Oz. Atlantis, The Lost Empire. Wait. No, I'm really confused. Didn't he do any Harry Potter movies? Apparently not. Well, that's crazy. Grindelwald? I don't know. Well, that's weird. So apparently he didn't do any. Oh, well. Okay, well, forget about it. It was a great soundtrack. I enjoyed it. It felt really Harry Potter-y. Or Harry Potter-ish, the way you say it. So I hope they keep him for the next movies as well. So all in all, I really enjoyed the movie. I want to see it again. I saw it in 3D, and it's great. Visually, it's amazing. It's even better than the first movie. And the fantastical creatures are cute and charming and interesting. And they're even more integrated into the story. They're not just gratuitous, like, look at this interesting creature, look at that. They all have a role in the story, which also makes this movie, I think, better than the first one. The only thing that I was missing a little bit, and I already realized afterwards, is the movie is not as funny as the first movie. The first movie, there were some really, laugh out loud moments, and there was a lot of humor in it. In the second movie, it's a bit darker. But then again, that was also the way in which the Harry Potter movies evolved. Remember, the first movie was all charming, and you kind of like see the magical world through the eyes of a young boy. And then the second movie gets darker, and the third one gets even darker, and the final movies were like war movies. So perhaps in this new saga, Rowling is trying to do the same. It's like, from the wonder and the vibrant colors in the first movie, we're already going to a more muted palette, and then gradually things may grow darker. And I have to say, the final scenes with Grindelwald were really scary, and there were some very dark moments also at the beginning of the movie. There is some stuff going on where it's like, wow. I mean, they don't show it, but what takes place off screen is pretty gruesome. So yeah, I think these movies are also probably gonna turn darker and darker over time. So that was my review of The Crimes of Grindelwald. Hope you enjoy it, and if you've seen the movie, let me know on Facebook or on Twitter what you thought.
When did you become an expert in thermonuclear astrophysics?
Last night. The packet. The extraction theory papers. Am I the only one who did the reading?
So now that I have my new reading chair in front of the non-existent fireplace, hopefully future fireplace, didn't they use the fireplaces in Harry Potter to move from one place to another? I have to check that out. Perhaps I can build one of those. Anyway, so now that I have my chair, I've been wanting to read something big, like sit down and read some Tolkien or something like that. And I finally decided to start reading perhaps one of the biggest book series, at least in the realm of fantasy literature, that we currently know. And that is the immense saga of Wheel of Time. Wheel of Time, I got interested in that a while ago. During one of the board games evenings that I spent with Sebastian, one of my parishioners, and some friends, and Ruland was one of the fellow players. And so we were chatting and he said, you know what, have you ever read The Wheel of Time? You got to read that. If you enjoy Tolkien, if you love fantasy, you got to read it. But warning, this is massive. I mean, we're talking about a ton of books. Let me see how many books are there. I'm looking at the Wikipedia page here. It is written by Robert Jordan, but he died before he was able to finish the book. And Brandon Sanderson, who was a fan of the Wheel of Time saga, but also was also a fantasy writer himself, and is now a very successful fantasy writer as well, completed the final book based on the notes that that Robert Jordan left. And so I think they expanded that final book into three volumes. So how many books are there? Let me see. Books in the series. Here we go. Oh, there are even some prequels. It's about 14 books. That's insane. And just to give you an idea of how many pages, like The Eye of the World, which is the first official part, there is a kind of a prequel. It's called New Spring, which was written in 2004. But The Eye of the World alone has 782 pages, 305,902 words. And that goes even up. Like, for instance, later on, The Shadow Rising has 981 pages. So we're talking big books. Fortunately, my Kindle can contain those tens of thousands of pages in the same, 5 millimeter thickness of the Kindle. That's why I love digital books. I don't want to think about, you know, having to get those paper books. It's an entire tree that goes into all those books. So I started to read The Eye of the World, and it's really well done. I was a bit afraid, apprehensive. I know sometimes with these authors that write these huge books, like for instance, Name of the Rose, you know, Umberto Eco. You start reading that, and the first 400 pages are like, oh, how do I get through this? There's just so much information, and it's so, like, look at me, I know so much. That's kind of the problem that I have with Umberto Eco. He's very studied, very, you know, it's all very interesting, but he's cramming in everything he knows in those books, and it takes forever for the story to get going. Well, so I was a bit afraid that with the Wheel of Time, it would be like that, but it's absolutely not the case. There's the first chapter is like kind of this epic introduction, which really reminds me of the introduction to the original Lord of the Rings movies, where they did this prologue, this introduction, you know, this is like, in the old myth turns, or what is it? History turns to myth turns to something, blah, blah, blah. So you have no idea what the mythological background is yet. Still very vague. And then the first chapter immediately just lures you in and gives a really good, it's a good, the world building is really good, and you feel that you're there and it feels familiar. It's a really nice fantasy world, and there's immediately stuff happening, and then you're wondering, okay, where is this going? Apparently the first book is not even representative for the rest of the series. Over time, Jordan starts to develop his style, and the narrative style changes from something that is more akin to Tolkien's writing in The Eye of the World and The Great Hunt to, you know, a very different style. I have no idea what that style is or what the genre is, but apparently you keep reading. And so looking at those 14 books, I think I will spend a lot of time in that reading chair. So I'm glad it's a good one.
Catholics rock!
In this episode of The Peculiar Bunch, I want to talk about one of my sources of inspiration, one of my examples as a priest.
Catholics can be a peculiar bunch. No meat on Friday.
No meat? What do they eat, light bulbs?
So, 2 or 3 weeks ago, I went to the north of the country to find out more about the life of Titus Bronsma.
Man, you guys got more crazy rules than Blockbuster Video.
Now, Titus Brandsma, that's how you pronounce it more or less in Dutch. I think you would say Titus in English. Brandsma was a Frisian boy who entered seminary and became a priest in the order of, in the Carmelite order. He was born in 1881 in Bolsward, and actually went to visit the farm where he was born. Now, of course, in case you don't know, he is beatified. He was beatified by John Paul II, and he is on the verge of becoming a saint. It's real close. There is a miracle that has now been approved in Florida. I think a priest in Florida was cured of cancer by invoking the intercession of Titus Brandsma. And he's not only venerated in the Netherlands as a saint, but also as a martyr for the faith. So I've always been fascinated by Brandsma. From the early days of my own vocation, when I entered seminary, someone gifted me a book about his life. And I read that book in a few days, and I was so enthralled and captivated by his life and the example and the sacrifice that he gave of his life, that I was like, okay, I want to be like him. And I remember that. And it's so cool years and years and years later to be going back to the places where he lived and encounter him again. And what makes his life is kind of not very special. I mean, he's a very intelligent guy, also a little bit, I wouldn't say shy, but a bit introverted, loves to study, loves to be, you know, in his cell, quiet, praying, thinking, writing. But he also becomes a teacher at the University of Nijmegen, and is active in a lot of Catholic organizations. And then National Socialism starts to grow. Hitler starts to make waves, and at one point, of course, the Netherlands is under the influence of the Nazis, and they start to retract a lot of the freedoms that's there, and most importantly, it becomes a menace to the freedom of press, and that's where Titus Brandsma gets his second vocation to do something about that. He's writing for a newspaper at the time. He loves to do that. He thinks it's important for the church to be present in the media. So that's another way in which he inspires me. And so he writes articles, etc. And people really appreciate his professionalism. And at one point, the Nazi party is forcing newspapers to place advertisements for the Nazis and for their practices, etc. And they're trying to rob the newspapers from the freedom of press. They're putting a lot of pressure on the newspapers. And Titus Brandsma goes and talks with the archbishop at the time, Cardinal de Jong, and feels that he has to do something. And so he goes to all those newspapers, one at a time, talks to the Catholic newspapers, and back then, of course, there were a lot of Catholic newspapers, talks to the people that work there and convinces them not to place those advertisements from the Nazis. He's very much convinced that the Nazi ideology is opposed to everything Christians stand for. It's about the value of every human life. It's about the innate worth and dignity of every human being. And of course, the Nazis were railing against that and trying to sow division in society and make certain groups seem lower or push them lower on the social ladder than let's say the Ubermensch, you know, the white the privileged white Nazi supporters. And so Titus Brandsma sees the danger of that and sees how dangerous that is for the values that the church stands for. And so he manages to convince all those newspapers to refuse the articles and the ads from the Nazis. That's when he becomes a target. And we know from sources that we discovered later on that the Nazis are trying to arrest him. But ultimately, they don't really know where he is at the time. And then one of the people that works for the last newspaper that he visits betrays him and tells the Nazis or the Germans where they can find him. And so he's apprehended. He's moved to a prison in Scheveningen near the North Sea, where he stays for a couple of weeks. He's very ill. He had a very weak health. So he gets ill, but still tries to make the most out of his time there. He's very supportive, gives a lot of pastoral care to his fellow inmates. We also know that from all the testimonies that were told after he died. Then he's moved to Amersfoort here. That's where I live currently. There was also a camp here of the Germans. And then from here, he's moved to Dachau. Or he's moved back briefly to Scheveningen, and from there he's moved to Dachau. And in Dachau, he turns really ill, and because Nazis were, people that were ill were not useful. They couldn't be put to work. So they end up killing him with a lethal injection, and they burn his body in one of the ovens. So that's how he ends. And we know that until the last moment, he's been praying, he's been helping his fellow inmates. And that's why he was beatified. And that's why I believe he's so important for us now. And I really hope that Pope Francis will canonize him. And I gave myself the task to do something about that. So I've decided to make a television episode about this. And I will also send the link to the apostolic nuns here. Nouns, I think it's nouns here in the Netherlands. He was from Italy and is not necessarily aware of how important that would be for Catholics, and not just Catholics, Christians in general in our country. Because again, I think a lot of the freedoms and the truth that Titus Brandsma fought for in his life is again being menaced. We live in an age of fake news, of politicians lying more than they speak, of even falsified photos and film clips and huge influence campaigns from foreign countries and all the trouble that we currently have with our social media, and how vulnerable we have become with this easily, modifiable, fluid digital content that's out there, that I think we need a patron saint for this kind of stuff. Someone who reminds us today, who reminds journalists today, what they stand for, what their work is all about. It's not just about making money and selling newspapers. It's about standing firm for the truth, telling people what's going on, give them the information they need to have to know what world they want to build. It's to expose the crimes of those that do evil in the world. It's to show us things that pass under the radar, the culture of death that is everywhere, and that a lot of, the influencers are trying to make us forget. Try to make us focus on Christmas decorations and sales and Black Friday and at the same time, our world is in dire need of love and help and truth. And well, for all those reasons, I really hope that Titus Brandsma will be canonized, so that he can become an example not just for the church here in the Netherlands, but for the worldwide church, for all of us who are trying to stand for the truth and to defend the truth against all those ideologies that are trying to destroy it. So there you go. That's my testimony. Over time, I hope to go to revisit his life and do not just a documentary in Dutch, which I've currently filmed, but I want to do one in English and do one that I can distribute internationally. This may be one of those projects that I want to bring to Netflix, is trying to do something that puts this great person on the map of everyone, because he deserves it, and we need examples like him. All right. And with that, we go to the world of technology.
We are on the cutting edge of technology. Wow. Well, what does that mean?
Let's plug it in. It's going to say, hey, I see you plugged in a new device. And it's going to load in the appropriate drivers. You'll notice that this scanner built... Whoa.
Well, all your technology stuff, it just ends in disaster.
But there is one more thing.
So I've set up Google Home system in my new rectory, which proved to be extremely difficult. When I arrived there, I didn't have any passwords for the Wi-Fi, and I didn't know how to. I saw that there were some Wi-Fi sources around the house, so I tried to log in. Didn't have the password, so. Finally figured it out after 2 days. In the meantime, I was using the data bundle on my phone, but that's not very ideal. And then the Wi-Fi was extremely weak and slow once I logged in. And the worst thing was I was apparently on some kind of a guest account, which you can set up in some routers. But what it does is you can log in, you can access the internet, but because it's a guest account, it is really limited. And if one device is connected to the network, it can't connect with other devices, which is an absolute necessity for the Google Home system to work. So I installed one Google Home Mini, but then it couldn't see the other Minis. It couldn't see my Chromecast. So, and since I didn't have, there is no wired connection anywhere in the rectory, at least not in the part where I live. So back then they thought that Wi-Fi was enough. I couldn't connect my computer to the internet as well. My computer doesn't have a Wi-Fi modem, so I needed to have an Ethernet cable, which I didn't have. So I ended up hooking it up to the TV, and then I thought, well, you know what? I can still watch TV at least, or watch some YouTube through my Chromecast. And then I installed the Chromecast, and then there's like, there has been an error. There's probably a setting in the router that you have to do. And I was like, what router? I don't even know where the router is in this home. So it took me more than a week to find the source of all the trouble, which is a modem in the parish part of the house that they installed, I think, in 2006. It's still on copper, and I knew that because apparently there had been a kind of a problem between the organization that was. Putting the Ethernet, we have fiber all over the city, and so they wanted to create a connection with the rectory as well. But then they dug a hole, and they didn't have permission for that. Then the people back then at the parish, they were mad at the company who dug the hole, and then they was like, "Oh, we will never take your fiber, and that's it. There will never ever be fiber in this house." And then 10 years later, hey, I'm Father Roderick. I'd like to have fiber. And well, there is no fiber. There's just copper wire, and a very slow connection. I was like, okay, I need fiber. So I started to make some phone calls, and finally ended up discovering the company that, you know, was responsible for the fiber connections in that part of the town. And I begged them, please, can I have fiber, please? And then they're like, okay, we'll send over a crew. We're installing more fiber connections in the neighborhood anyway, so we'll do that for you. So now there is a fiber connection, but that's it. There is no modem. There's still the only internet that is there at the rectory is the old copper connection, the ADSL connection. And I did finally, after more than a week, figured out how to connect not to the guest Wi-Fi, but to the other Wi-Fi, which had this code name, and it's like totally opaque. Couldn't figure it out myself, so I had to find the person in the parish that knew the password and knew how to log in, and then at least I could connect the other home minis. I still don't have much Wi-Fi upstairs, so in some rooms there is no. The Wi-Fi signal is too small because they have these very old, signal enhancers, and none of those signal enhancers are in my part of the building. They're all on the other side of the wall for the parish, and so it has to travel through the walls, and that's why I don't have enough coverage in my home, and I don't have a wire. So once I'm back from Israel, I need to take care of that because it's really hard right now. It's like this involuntary Lenten time, this Wi-Fi Lent. There are evenings, especially when the Chromecast didn't work and I couldn't watch anything
not even a Blu-ray. It's stupid. In order to watch a Blu-ray disc, your Blu-ray player has to connect to the internet. At least mine does. And it couldn't because I didn't have an Ethernet cable. So the only thing I could do was read books. Now, there's nothing wrong with that. But I started to really miss, my Netflix episodes. And I wanted to watch Doctor Who, and I couldn't. And the only way I could do that was through my data bundle on my phone. Well, if you've ever tried to watch a movie on a phone, especially when you're an old guy like me, it doesn't work. So anyway, that's solved now. There's at least I can watch stuff through Chrome. And so I only got the Chromecast to work 2 days ago. And then I was like, oh, finally, every evening I can watch some Netflix and watch some more Doctor Who. No, wait, I got to go to Israel. That's another week without Netflix. Oh, my gosh. But anyway, there's more. That's another reason to look forward to my Christmas holidays. Internet game. I haven't played a single video game for a month now. Can you believe that? I'm getting so much withdrawal symptoms. It's crazy. Anyway, I'm also looking at the other technology. In the meantime, since the last episode that I recorded, we had the Apple presentation of the new iPads and the MacBook Air and the Mac Mini. None of that was really interesting to me. The MacBook Air just looks like the other MacBook that was out there. I saw it in the store earlier today and I was like, yeah, it looks good, but expensive. And, well, why would people buy a MacBook Air when for almost the same price you can buy a regular MacBook, which is much faster? Anyway, I'm not in the market for a laptop right now. I was interested by the iPads, and I got to see them in real life today. And I have to say that I was impressed and I was underwhelmed. I mean, what I like about the new iPads is that they have this tiny border. So they finally got rid of the big, huge side borders, you know, one the home button and all that unnecessary stuff. So I like that. But I still think that the 11-inch iPad is a tad too small. My eyes are getting worse, or, you know, I have to wear glasses sometimes to read a book. Fortunately, with the Kindle, you can, you know, change the font size. But if I spend a lot of time looking at my phone, for instance, I get a headache. So what I like about the bigger size, the 12.6-inch, is that it is bigger. It's the size of a magazine. And knowing how much I read on my iPad, it's my go-to device for reading anything, browsing the web, reading the news, listening to podcasts. I carry it with me when I'm home all the time. I'm using it for all the jingles in this show as well. It's definitely the device that I use the most in my life, much more than my phone. So I look at this 12.6-inch, which is smaller than the predecessor, which was massive, but I was disappointed because it's still heavy. It's really heavy. It's thick. And I don't see myself carrying this around. Perhaps not even in the house. Now, sometimes I just read when I'm in bed, I read the comics on the iPad. Well, even for that, I think the big iPad may be too big. I don't know. It just, now when I'm reading from my iPad in a chair or something like that, after a while, it just feels heavy. And I get tingling in my hands and I need to put it down. I don't have that with the Kindle. The Kindle is a perfect weight. But the iPad is heavy. The big iPad, even though I would love to read on a big screen like that, is still too heavy to be comfortable over time. At least that's how I feel. Perhaps some of you already have that big iPad, so let me know. Perhaps I should just, you know, train and get stronger muscles in my hands and arms to carry that, because I really like it. And the other thing that was disappointing, very disappointing, is the pricing of these devices. You can really tell that Apple is losing market share. They're not selling as many devices as they did in the past. They're even now currently, and that's causing a lot of upheaval among investors. They're not going to tell us anymore how many devices they sold. They're just going to give us an overall number, which includes the services. And so a lot of investors are reading that as a sign that Apple's sales are slowing down. And I think one of the reasons that these prices are so skyrocketing high now of these new devices is that Apple tries to tap in the wallets of the Apple aficionados, those that are already completely in this Apple ecosystem. And if you have invested a lot in the ecosystem, you have a lot of apps that you paid for and games, and you're subscribed to Apple Music, which I'm not. You may have an entire iTunes library full of stuff that you bought. You can't really go back to Android. There's no way out. And so you have to, if you want to buy a new version of your devices, you got to stay with Apple. And so Apple can actually charge you more than they did in previous years. However, there are signs that that is backfiring. The Apple XR, the let's say the simplest iPhone that they presented earlier this year, doesn't sell at all, at least not as much as everyone expected. And I think it is because of the price. They're pitching this as the cheap iPhone. And it's like, whoa, this thing is like between 800 and 900 euros. That's not a cheap phone. That is, for the same price, you have the top of the line Samsung phone or anything else. So it is, what Apple now presents as cheap is because the rest is so incredibly expensive that even the expensive phone now kind of feels cheap to some people. I don't know, but it's not selling. And I think Apple will have to lower its prices. You can't get so much more value for money if you go for, you know, some of the Android phones. You won't have the Apple ecosystem. And yeah, Android is good, but it's not as good as Apple. But are people willing to pay the price, to continue to pay that price? I don't know. I'm waiting for this iPad to go down in price over time. So yeah, and before that, I'll just get new reading glasses. What else can I do? And let's see. Well, you know what? I think it's time to wrap things up here. I've been talking for an hour now. And so next week I'll be in Israel. I'll take my audio recorder with me, so perhaps I'll record something when I'm there, an episode of The Walk or something like that. But by the way, if you haven't listened to the latest episode of The Walk, go check it out on Tridio.com. That's where you find all my other stuff, and that's also where you can find out how to support me. Go to patreon.com/FatherRoderick if you want to find out more about that. Thanks for listening. See you soon.